Hello, welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Daryl Tonema, American Indian Counseling Psychologist of Kiowa, Comanche, and Tuscarora heritage. He has three bachelor's degrees in psychology, sociology, and gerontology, a master's degree in community counseling, and a PhD in counseling psychology and cultural studies. Dr. Tonema is a trauma-informed counselor who works with Native groups across the United States and Canada. Dr. Tonema, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. Honored to be here.
So how did you get interested in trauma work?
I grew up on several different reservations. And at the time, trauma wasn't even a word. It wasn't even a concept that many years ago. And I was probably around fifth grade, sixth grade. And my friends were coming to school. Either they had bruises, or even at that early age, they were smelling like alcohol. And my dad ran the clinic, the Indian hospital there in our little community on the res there. And I started asking him questions. I tell them what was going on. And again, this is a different time, and reporting things were different. It was just a whole different era. And right. Some of our people in our community have some tough things happen. And sometimes the parents are struggling. It's been this way for a long time. He's talking about intergenerational historical trauma. And those weren't even words yet. He's just saying this has been happening a long time. And I said, ask what I can do to help, because we had been raised to get an education and then help your people. Get an education to help your people. And that was very ingrained in us from even before I was in fifth, sixth grade. And we talked about medicine, and we talked about social work, and I had heard of social work. And he said, "You're not very good at paperwork, Daryl." And you know, at that age, you knew that I wouldn't be good at that. And we ended up talking about psychology, and I kind of made a decision to get into psychology to work with this community that had a lot of symptoms of the trickle downs of trauma. And I thought, well, let's run toward that. And thankfully, blessedly, over my career, I've been able to learn more and experience more and put research into practice, and then actually learn from that practice so it becomes better and stronger and can benefit other people. That's really the genesis of that.
Thank you for sharing that part of your story with us. So what is sovereignty, and how does it relate to trauma?
So sovereignty is an important word for Native communities. Like I said, that's my key audience. I do a lot of work in other universities and hospitals and clinics and things like that. But sovereignty has always been a word that's been present in my home and growing up and in the communities that I grew up in. And sovereignty in the socio-cultural perspective is we are autonomous in our capacity for laws and finances and ceremony and language. That's what sovereignty is in that socio-cultural perspective. And so that word always stuck with me because it meant we are who we are, and we are the best versions of who we are. We have the capacity to enhance who we are. And the more I started doing trauma work, trauma really wants to limit those things. Everything I listed about how we can become autonomous and take care of ourselves and believe in ourselves and strive and thrive. Trauma, that's the opposite of what trauma wants. Trauma's goal is to have a person hiding in their bedroom underneath the covers, shaking. That's trauma's end game. And being a bully like that, I think, well, that's the opposite of what I want for myself, my kids, my community, people in general, the folks I work with. And so when I think about personal sovereignty, then personal sovereignty is how do I reclaim what makes me autonomous? Can I control my heartbeat, my heart rate in this moment? Can I slow down my breathing? Can I get my thinking back online in this moment? And once I realize I have that capacity in this moment, does that extrapolate or interpolate or whatever that word is to the next moment, to other areas of my life? Can I take this tool and put it here and put it here, become sovereign there and become sovereign there, become sovereign in all these different locations, not just right here? And that does happen, and that can happen. It doesn't happen by accident.
Right.
Just like in a social culture perspective, we don't gain our sovereignty by accident. We go out and grab it and say, here's who we want to be. And when working with traumatized folks, the generating that belief that I can reclaim this thing that trauma is trying to steal away from me insidiously, little by little, or sometimes in big chunks. And so rather than saying, well, that's just how it's going to be, which is giving up our sovereignty, how can I claim it in this moment? And then how can I learn from this moment and claim it in other moments? I have a story about, I went to a reservation in the Midwest a couple of years ago. And I go to a school that is on a community that was just very, a lot of tough stuff in that community. High rates of poverty and abuses and alcoholism. It's a tough situation in the community. And I go to the school in that community and I get to work with the kids. I work with the kids in their classrooms, and I get to work with the teachers and counselors and skill building and tool building and things like that. And it just so happened that that day I was there a couple of years ago, it might've been like last 2 years ago, May, they're having their spring concert, spring sync in the gym. And the gym just old, and it was in the bad shape and poorly lit, but the kids were in there singing. And there was probably 10 people in the audience. And I was seeing the kids that I work with, and I see them when they're struggling the most and they're most overwhelmed. And I see them singing, which is totally out of context for me. I couldn't sing. I didn't know that was on your menu. But they're singing, right. It's spring. I'm so happy it's spring. And I'm just enjoying the heck out of it, because I thought, man, there's hope here. And I was just clapping. And then I get a tap on my shoulder. And one of the teachers says, Dr. T, can you come outside? One of the kids is freaking out on the swings outside. And I thought, I'm enjoying this. But I said, right. Of course I'm outside. So I went outside, and there's this little boy, he's probably in fourth, fifth grade, and he's hanging on to the swings. He's got the chains and he's just hanging on. He's white knuckling it and just bawling. And there were several people around him, like kneeling with good hearts, wonderfully intentioned, saying, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And as you know, the what's wrong question isn't to be asked right now, because it could be one of millions of things. It could be something that he doesn't even consciously connect to.
Exactly.
So he's not aware of necessarily that. So we're dealing in hypothetical when we're asking that question. What's wrong? Could it be? Could it be? Could it be? Which is my cognitive behaviorism. Could it be right. This? Could it be this? You know, we just stare our head down rabbit holes. But we
feels
don't have
very similar to when we notice a behavior that we don't like in a child, and we say something like, why would you do that? Right. It's
right.
Asking for cognition and recognition and understanding that they don't have access to maybe yet.
Right. Exactly. And the more we ask that question, the more they get frustrated, the more we get frustrated, because
right.
They don't know the answer. So we're asking an unanswerable question at that point. So we're dealing in all this hypothetical. But in that moment, let's deal with the facts. The facts are, my heart's pounding. I can't breathe. I can't think. I'm hot. My limbs are tingly. Those are the facts right now. So we can deal with the other stuff later. But let's do the facts, man. And so I just asked if I can borrow him for a second. And so I sit on the swing next to him. And And you know through all the research that a child, or even us, but we look for the safest person in an environment when we're stressed like this.
Absolutely.
Dramatic moment. And you've seen this when babies fall down, the first thing they do is look at the adult to see, how should I be right now? And if the adult is like, then the baby's like, got it. But if the adult is like, sup? And the baby's like, just chilling. So they borrow safety.
Yeah.
And that's why going into any kind of trauma work, we take care of ourselves first. Because going into that moment, they're going to read. And if I'm stressed and overwhelmed, not even consciously, but if my pupils are somewhat dilated, or if my cheeks are somewhat flushed, they're going to read that and say, this is a big thing. So they need to borrow some of our safety as providers. And so I sit next to him and I just do sit for a second. And genuinely want to feel myself become more present and calm and grounded. And I just say, this is a big one. This feels pretty big. And I say, you know, I feel it right here too. And I said, do you want a flute lesson? And he is, what kind of question is that, dude? And I said, you want a flute lesson? And I said, I think my flute's in my car. And so I go out, and the car was, here's the playground, there's the school, and there's a little hill right here, and my car was right here. And I said, let me just run to the car, meet me on this hill here. So he sits on the hill, and I go to my car, and I get my flute out. And I wanted him to breathe. You know, my heart rate variability, mm-hmm. breathing, the slowing the tempo, and slowing the game down, getting the acetylcholine flowing. I wanted him to experience that. And he's like, like that. And he's just tears and snot. It was just a gross situation. Okay. And so I say, well, your first flute lesson isn't about playing the flute. The first flute lesson is about breathing. So here's how, when you breathe into a flute, you don't blow into a flute, because when you blow, it does this. It sounds bad. You breathe. And I'm watching my prosody, watching my tempo and the tone of my voice and the timbre and all this stuff. Because again, he's still borrowing my safety. And I say, how about, watch this. I do that with him. And I said, how about, as long as you hear me blow a note, you be breathing. That's your first flute lesson. I wasn't even talking about trauma or stress or his sense of overwhelm in this moment.
Right. You weren't telling him, I need you to take deep breaths. You weren't telling him, I need you to calm down. You weren't saying, like, tell me what's happening with you. All you said was, hey, I'm going to play the flute. You want to join me? I love it.
And he doesn't have to know that that's this. We're going to create acetylcholine for your heart to slow down. He doesn't have to know any of that stuff. He just wants to know, I want to feel better now. And it's much different teaching one to be calm than to say calm down. Those are just two totally different of the spectrum. And so he starts breathing and he's still crying like that. And I says, keep trying. And so we go through it 5-6 times. And you can see him coming back. And I say come back because you know about the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic. Yeah. He's coming back. And here's the whole thing, almost fell off the rails, Megan. I said, you want to play? Snot?
So, oh, no.
I gave him that flute. This is not that flute. And so he first does this. Like I said, no. And then he holds it and he just... And I said, now lick a finger. I told him lift two fingers. And then three. And I just wanted him to, wasn't that about the flute playing?
Of course, yeah.
But it was about him recognizing his capacity for sovereignty in that moment. And that if I could have sat there and asked him, why are you doing this, for about 2 hours and watch him struggle. But again, why would we want to deal with a hypothetical when we know the facts and we have tools to address the facts? And those tools that address those facts makes him feel better fast. And so we sat, talked for just a couple more minutes. The whole thing took like 7-8 minutes. And then I talked a little bit. I just said, he stopped crying and he was back. He was present again. And the whole thing, like I said, took that short amount of time. And then I said, you know, sometimes when we're at home, hard things happen. Things we don't like happen. And it feels kind of like this at home too, I imagine sometimes. And I said, maybe just go into the closet or the bathroom or the backyard and take the flute with you and just play flute for a while. And do it the way that you learned here. And I said, do you want to play some more? He said, nope. And he got up and ran into the gym. And I was there. And I sat there on the hill by myself with my flute. No, he took the flute with the flute bag. And that was a very telling lesson for me. It just reinforced. And the teachers got to see it, because sometimes we have to, there's a learning curve to learning otherwise. And it was very telling for them that they learned otherwise in that moment, how quickly they can bring themselves or their students back, and how important it is that they are projecting actual safety, not just saying, right, I am, but actually being safe. So they can borrow that. They can, it's for loan. And the more that we practice it on our end, on an ongoing basis, on a daily basis, the more when these occasions arrive, we can readily just hand it out and help those around us heal, as we heal in community with each other. And I always like to say that we heal in community and we suffer in silos. And that's one of the things I said earlier about the bully of trauma. It loves you to be in a silo because that's its sweet spot. But the more we connect, the more we borrow each other's safety, the more we create communities of healing, the more we create gatherings of the mighty, the more we heal as groups of people, which is how we're supposed to heal, and which is how we heal. Feels like I'm talking a lot right now, so go ahead and ask me another question.
No, yeah, you've done a fantastic job. I let people speak when they're making great points. And I love what you said as well, because whether it's the teachers or any other circumstance or a child, telling someone and teaching someone something, there's a lot of value in that, but demonstrating it and just showing it, as you said, I love that term, borrowing safety. And as you said, it starts with you, period. Like, even in that moment, you had to start with you and just sit down on the swing and like make sure that you were grounded and in the swing and had your own breath and had your own ability to create and have that safety for him. And then being able to show the teachers and demonstrate, like, here's how I'm going to do this, without ever telling this child to calm down, without ever asking what's wrong. And I know that you can speak to this, that so much of what we know about trauma and the way that we're treating it now has nothing to do with reliving or retelling, or there's so many other methodologies for people for whom that retelling and that rehashing might not be helpful.
Right. And that's unkind. If somebody comes in here and maybe it's our first or second session, I'm still pretty much a stranger to that person.
Right.
So, hi, I'm a stranger. Tell me all the worst details, the worst thing that's happened to you, and leave crying. You're welcome. Pay at the door. That's a very unkind model. And I think just even from the beginning, helping people lean into these I call them these tools that are otherwise. They're just unfamiliar. They're very successful and very well researched. They're just not familiar. And I can be honest with you, when I first started, I myself was saying, well, tell me all about that. And I would be sitting there stressed myself.
Yeah.
Because this person was becoming very activated. They're plugging in. And I thought, well, what do I say? What do I say that's going to, and then as I've grown as a professional, there's not a million-dollar question. There's not that thing that I'm going to say or the question I'm going to ask that's going to heal them, that it doesn't exist. What I prefer now and what I've learned and how I've grown as a provider is many of the folks that I see they're using a lot of external tools for internal events. Mm. So the sense of overwhelm that's been stored in me since a childhood, and it feels like this, and I don't have the internal tools because maybe I come from a traumatized community or traumatized home. I'm not taught internal tools, but I see a lot of external tools modeled. And so to get rid of this, maybe I drink or hit or smoke or eat or use. And so I'm using these external tools to address an internal event. And so our journey, our hero's journey for this person then is, let's develop some internal tools for internal events. And these internal tools are portable. And wherever you are, whenever you are, you develop these set of tools. And it's important that I will say, once we start learning these tools, I'll tell the folks that you are not toolless in this battle anymore. Right. It is, you're not fighting it alone. You don't have to white knuckle this and hope it goes away, because that's not how sovereignty behaves. Right. Sovereignty behaves like, you be quiet because I'm in charge in this moment. And that's, man, when people start to recognize that, it is a beautiful thing. I've had folks say, because we'll be here in the office or online here, and we'll get there. You can see their bodies shift. You can see them start to come back to calm, to start feeling sovereign. And they'll get this little smirk on their face. Almost invariably, and the shoulders will come down. And I like almost get a lump in my throat when I watch them, because I'm like, dude, it's happening right now. I'm watching someone reclaim right now. It's such an awesome one. And you can see them deflate and get that smirk. So that's that part of it. But then I'll say, how does your body feel like now? What does your body feel like right now? And here's what they'll say at the beginning is, my heart's not pounding. I'm not hot. My legs aren't shaking. So they're saying things that aren't.
My breathing's not rapid. Like they're saying what they aren't instead of what they are. Yeah.
And that's it. And we're almost there. But they're just waiting for the shoe to drop, though, because it's going to happen again, but it's not happening right now. So I just say, well, what if we called that peace? What if we labeled the sense of warmth and connectedness? Instead of saying this isn't happening, let's say this is happening. Mm. And I am involved. I am autonomous in making this occur within me, which seems like maybe even a semantic shift, but it's a chasm.
Right.
Because if you're perpetually waiting for the other shoe to drop, then even that in itself is stressful.
Right.
But if we can embrace, well, this is what peace feels like. And I've had, and you probably heard several people say this, I've had people say they've never felt like that before.
Right.
Which is, when I think about it, that's probably true. If this happened when they were 5 and they're now 60, for 55 years, they've been carrying this boulder around. And finally, they put that boulder down and they said, wow, this is what this feels like, not be carrying this right now. That is a sovereign moment.
Yeah.
And we chase, we seek these sovereign moments. We start stacking up these sovereign moments. And pretty soon, we just become defined by our sovereignty as an individual. And then we develop capacity to loan that out to other people. That's kind of the foundation of my approach, I guess. I don't even know what the word is, but what the work that I love to do and the work that I get to do. and I don't feel overwhelmed anymore when people come in. I feel like, let's knock this thing out. Let's see what you got under the hood.
And I know you're capable of this capability. Yeah.
Yes. And maybe before I learned otherwise, I wasn't totally aware of that. I was hopeful.
Right.
But now it seems much more practical.
And as you were speaking about like the tools that people do develop when they don't know any better, right? I have so much empathy for people with traumatic experiences or traumatic presence is, that's not a word, but you know what I'm saying, where their current environment is not safe, or their current community is not safe, or they've experienced something where they have not had anyone model the tools or the safety. And I just have a lot of empathy for people who reach for the tool that they have, right? Because so much of what we're dealing with when we deal with trauma is trying to escape those, either the thoughts, the, you know, prisons of our own minds, or our body sensations. And so we've got tools. We've just been reaching for the wrong tools because nobody's showed us a different way and a different methodology. We haven't seen it modeled. We haven't had it demonstrated. And so to just be retaught different tools before we ever have to unpack all of that trauma, it's just such a valuable experience that I know that you have given to people, that you've experienced yourself. I've experienced it as well. Just to share a short anecdote with you, I had an experience a couple of weeks ago where I was activated in kind of like trauma anxiety for the first time in years. And my experience now that I can talk about it is that I'm so proud of myself because I didn't have any tools before. And now, like, even though I was completely activated, I was able to say, like, I was able to be present with like, wow, my breathing is really fast and heavy. And my heart is beating really hard. I can feel it in my chest. And like, I was able to be there and be present with all of those experiences. I couldn't stop them from happening. Like the reaction was going to happen. It was out of my control. But I was able to be there with it, and it didn't hijack me. It didn't take over my entire being. I didn't, you know, use any bad tools to cope with those things. I had my whole arsenal of things that I've learned and practiced from amazing professionals like you, and was able to just have an uncomfortable experience that activated me. And then it was over.
Wow. What a cool way to word that. I just had an uncomfortable experience. It wasn't the definition of me. It didn't ruin my life. I just had an uncomfortable experience. I'm going to bogart that. That sounds cool. I just had an uncomfortable experience, and it doesn't define me. It was just an uncomfortable experience. That's great and good for you. And to know that I have internal tools for this internal event, and I don't have to externalize this. That's great. You know, one of the things that you just shared that I think is so significant and is really the foundation of trauma work is getting to know that information and just calling it that information.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just information my body's giving me. And yes. Depending how the amygdala or the thalamus or the prefrontal are all going to respond.
Right.
It's how do I respond to this information that I'm giving you? That's what I love about going into schools and working with teachers or counselors is starting that process at a much younger age. Rather than 50 years of rocks and boulders we've picked up, we are saying, let's not pick them up to begin with.
Yes.
And it starts with just foundationally, what is this? How do you know what's that? The schools I go to, an overwhelming amount of fights and behavioral problems happen during gym class. Mm. And in gym class, your heart's pounding, you're hot, you're tingly, you're sweaty, you're and that's the same sensation base as what happened at home. So it's a mislabeling of, it's not excitement, it's fear or it's anger. And they respond accordingly based on the labels that they're giving them. So what we do when I get to visit schools or gym classes is we'll get after it, and then we'll just stop and become autonomous in that moment, claim some sovereignty in that moment. We just slow down, slow the game down, do some breathing, let's pick it up again. And actually, you're greasing up that pendulation. In Levine's work, you're greasing up that pendulation. So what you're trying to do is create this moment where I was like this, but now I'm like this. We have to teach them to know the difference, to discern. And we can give it different labels. This is not fear or frustration or anger. It's excitement. But they feel the same. But they feel the same way in us.
Especially so in a young brain. Yeah, absolutely. Before I've learned the different range of emotions, like I'm going to conflate those two things. I'm going to arousal in this way, if they match in heartbeat and physicality and sweating, are going to be kind of grouped together. And the outcome of that arousal is going to be the same if I've only had one practiced outcome at home or, you know, in whatever environment.
That's exactly it. And if we can get them early enough even if I'm working with somebody here in my office and they're still cognitively present, I can say, how do you know it's anger and not something else? Because, you know, joy has the same affect as well.
Yeah.
My heart beats fast. My breathing is more shallow. I'm tingly. Joy has the same sensation basis.
Yeah.
So really looking at the nuances and understanding and you know, when we get activated, we have trouble contextualizing things. So why would I feel joy now instead of excitement or fear or anger? It's very empowering. And the earlier we start, the better. It's not saying that it's not impossible later, but we just want to help them out to carve a different path earlier in life, make it easier for them.
And it's so interesting because, you know, I'm not necessarily the greatest person at dinner parties because all I want to talk about is trauma. People often find that off-putting, but I just find all of this work incredibly fascinating and I love talking to people about it. But one of the things is that people don't understand, like, well, why is this such a big thing now? And it's exactly like you just said, that in your career, the way that you've learned how to and been taught to and the things you've learned and the coping skills that you're able to teach people has changed. We know more. The science is much better now. And so our ability to give children especially better tools at a much younger age is, I mean, if we want to talk about community, I don't think that there's any better effect that we could have on community than to teach children how to deal with these emotions, give them different tools. And just a short story from my life. I mean, I remember a few years, probably 3 or 4 years ago, right after I had started my kind of personal trauma work, I noticed that when I was getting activated with my kids, that I would purse my lips. I would like, you know, and then I noticed this behavior I have two sons. And they would be wrestling or playing and kind of like fighting. And then there was always a point of escalation where it would end badly. It would always end in tears, even if it started good-heartedly and in good spirits. And so I sat them down and I said, you know, I've really noticed that when I'm getting impatient with you and when I'm about to lose my cool and when I'm getting escalated, that I do this. What do you guys think you do? Right. So like, I started it with like, here's what I've noticed about myself. So it didn't feel like you're doing something wrong. You're, you know, out of control. And they were both able to identify like parts of their behavior. And so now they know, like they'll verbalize, they'll be fighting. And so I'll hear what my one kid say, like, he does the same thing I do. He's like, oh, I just pursed my lips together. I got to cool off. Right. But it's just like this, you don't have to come from a horribly traumatized background or home to learn these tools, to learn, to take responsibility for your own activations, for your own role in your relationships, for your own role in your community and how you contribute to the atmosphere of your community.
Right. You need to know yourself a little better. There's a significant block between mind and body when there's traumas, particularly physical type traumas. And I'll have folks that are self-soothing, like you're doing, and don't even know. They'll be sitting here and they'll just be doing this with their hands, and not know that they're doing that, or they're doing this with their chest, or they're crossing their legs, and they're doing all sorts of self-soothing behavior. They're saying, my body feels out of control right now. And when I point that out, and they'll look like shocked. I don't know my hands were doing that. They were so disconnected. And part of the process of not just dealing, but healing. And I think that's an important distinction. And I don't throw the word healing around loosely.
Right.
Because it's a word with weight to it. But we've come from a place of let's deal with this. Let's ignore it or avoid it and think about butterflies and flowers and
stuff it down.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's deal with this. And so I have a coping skill, which coping skills are fine, but I want people to feel sovereign. I want them to punch it in the nose. And so dealing with it though, if they're perpetually dealing with it, that takes up a lot of time of your day. And then pretty soon, you're just kind of pushing it upriver, and you're going to catch up to it eventually. And then eventually, pretty soon, just the time waiting for it to catch up becomes stressful. And then you end up dealing with that. And then, so pretty soon, the dealing seasons just become shorter and shorter. Whereas healing is, well, it doesn't have the same capacity. It doesn't have the same power.
Yes.
In life anymore. So I have a scar right here on my wrist here. When I was a little chubby kid on the res in North Dakota, and I had my Captain Kangaroo hairdo. You remember Captain Kangaroo?
Oh yes, absolutely.
We used to have snowball fights, and for some reason, trailers are always dumped on the res. They would come from off res and just dump them on the res, and then they'd get stacked up along this fence line. So there were like 30 old trailers, and perfect place for rowdy kids to have snowball fights. And they were all sawed in half. You know how they ship them sawed in half?
Yeah.
And so my buddy was in there, and my buddy behind me threw a snowball at him, and he put the snow in his hand and did this, and it melted, and then it froze. In North Dakota, it freezes in like 2 seconds. And then he threw it at my friend that was in the trailer half, and it hit him right in the forehead, this ice ball. You could hear it echo throughout North Dakota. And he came back, he like bent at his knees and then came straight back up with a crazy look in his mouth. And he picked up a window frame. He lost it and threw it at my friend behind me. And I was in front of my friend. Like I said, I was this little heavier kid with a candy, and I was probably eating a candy bar or something. And they said, "Daryl, look out." And I do this, and it comes across my wrist right here. And it just gushed. And I ran home, and the guy from the trailer is running next to me, and he's saying, and it's just like doing this. And he's saying, "Come to my house, I'll get you a Band-Aid." And I'm like, "Dude." And so I get to my house, and I have 7 brothers and sisters. And it was laundry day, and it was sock day. And mom used to obsess about socks. They had to match. And so I look at the door, and I see she's doing socks. And I thought, I'm gonna die. She's not gonna take me to the hospital, she's doing socks. Here's the miracle of the story. She grabbed one of the socks and put it on my wrist. Long story short, stitches. And being a rowdy kid, they lasted about a week, and then I was playing football. And so I have a scar on my arm now. Why do I tell you that long story?
I know you're coming around.
I'll come around, I hope. I don't know. We'll see. It's not bleeding anymore. It's not even hurting anymore. I don't even think about it until I tell you on a video cast. It's healed. I don't have to deal with it anymore. I have to say, "Ooh, is this going to bleed today?" I don't have to worry about it today because it's healed. And so when we talk about healing, this internal sense of healing, it doesn't come back bleeding on us because we've become sovereign over it. And so understanding the shift from dealing to healing. And we're in a season of work in psychology and in neurology that we know so much more about how the body and the brain behave and heal. And there's so many folks learning these tools. There's so much access to great information right now that's sitting right in our laps. And I just am happy to be part of this conversation, but just happy to be a provider during this season.
Absolutely. It's an exciting time to do this work. And I know that you didn't know it was going to be like this by this time, but I'm so glad that you're doing the work. I'm going to wrap this up, but I do want to ask you about one more experience because I think it's just such a great story. Is that your family experienced a tornado and kind of what that taught you about traumatic experiences with the example and kind of experiment of your family?
Yeah, it's probably unethical for me to do research on my family. So I didn't formally, but we were, I was working at the University of Oklahoma, and this is a really long story, so I'll keep it short. Our house was hit by a tornado, and it was my wife, myself, and our two older kids. We didn't have our youngest son, Jack yet, but Carminda, Gracie, Parker, and myself. And we were hiding in a closet, and the tornado destroyed the house and left our closets. We took the roof and twisted the house, but left our closet for us. And we had vastly different experiences of the tornado. Somatic, because when the sirens were going off, just like a good Oklahoman, I went outside to see where the tornado was.
Obviously, as a Midwestern girl, I can tell you that's exactly what I would do.
So I walked out of my back porch, and the tornado was, in fact, in my driveway. And so I turned around to run back in, and it tried to pick me up a couple times. It dribbled me across my back porch. And I was using that charge, the fight or flight charge, for what it was intended to be used for. I was fighting and flighting. Exactly. So that charge was intended for. My family was hiding in a closet. And that charge settled in different ways. So I have an entirely different experience of it. Memory, it didn't really store in me because I used it up. Whereas right. My wife has very scattershot memory of the event. Gracie, the four horsemen of trauma showed up in from hyperarousal. Parker was this hyperarousal. Gracie was constriction. And probably all of them in Sydney Closet were having some sort of dissociative state.
Yeah.
We had the whole gamut of what it can present like. And using these tools, and I get to say this, and then I'm so proud of it, using these tools, because this is where I get to the research and say, well, where is this showing up and how is it showing up? That using these tools and the existing research, we've healed. We've gotten rid of it. We've gotten rid of the charge. And from constriction to the hyperarousal to the dissociation, they are back and
yeah,
stronger for the experience. Sure, we'd rather not have had the experience, but
obviously, yeah,
we wanted to be sovereign in determining how it was going to be in us. And that's really what I want for myself and my family and the folks that I get to work with. Is become self-determined in those ways.
And that's a perfect example. Thank you so much for sharing it. It's a perfect example of why this work and your work and the tools and why teaching them are so important, because you don't get to decide how your whole entire system is going to deal with something. You just don't, you don't get a choice. And I think that's one of the things that people often misunderstand is that if people share a universal experience, that they're all going to have the same reaction, or that you know, you show up as yourself and then the world happens to you. And that's going to, you know, things completely out of your control are going to determine how that is interpreted in your body and in your mind. And it's the tools and the help of safe people in your life that help you digest and heal and grow through that. So well said. Thank you.
I couldn't have said that better. So I'm going to steal what you just said there too. I'm going to bogart that.
Fantastic. I'm glad I could be here for you today.
That's an excellent learning point though. People digest it in different ways. You're absolutely right.
Just like, you know, one of my kids can't eat lactose. We're all going to digest things differently, right? And the fact that it's out of your control, I think, is just something that people really need to hear. It's not whatever way that you interpreted something terrible that happened to you. It's just, that's not your fault. What you do from here is your responsibility and is up to you, and is it completely at your disposal. But all right, so go ahead.
I tell folks, because trauma being the bully, they'll say things. I'm like, I just feel crazy because I don't understand. Let's not even worry about understanding. You're not crazy or broken or ruined. This is just the way it's behaving in your body right now. And so let's meet it there from point of sovereignty.
Right. Because trying to understand and trying to make your body deal with it differently is like trying to push that tornado off the porch. It's right. Just not
telling it to
that's
go
a
away.
Losing battle.
Right. So then, well, let's use the tools to not have the tornado live in us.
Absolutely. Dr. Daryl Tonemoth, thank you very much. How can people find out more about you and your work?
I have a website, Tonemoth, TONEMAH.com. And there's contact information in there. We have a telehealth, which is fntelehealth.com. But yeah, if you want to just reach out and shoot us an email, I'd love to hear from you. I sit in my office waiting to hear from you. So,
and Dr. Tonema is quite the musician as well. So you'll have that bonus if you go search him out and seek him out.
Yeah, I forgot to say that. Yes, I'm a huge rock star. So
wonderful to speak with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.